In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be speaking with Edward Ball. Back in 1998, he published a book that was an exploration of his family's slaveholding past. The title of that book, Slaves in the Family, it received the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 1998. At the time that he was working on that book, he got a phone call from a distant relative, a woman named Edwina Harlston Whitlock, who was trying to enlist his support into writing the history of her family that was, in a sense, his family, too, because of their relationship, distant but there. She had accumulated a lot of material on the family and somehow felt not quite capable of doing this, writing this story, and she persuaded him to do it, and he did, and it's now been published as a book. It's titled The Sweet Hell Inside, about a family called the Harlstons that came to become, in the years after the Civil War, one of the wealthiest African-American families in Charleston. The book presents a part of the story of African-America that isn't always told, and that is of the rise of a middle class in the years after the Civil War. The book is published by William Morrow and Company. It's just out now. Our guest, Edward Ball, was born in Georgia. He was raised in the South. He worked in New York as an art critic. He's now making his home in Charleston in South Carolina. He's joining us by phone. And questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Ball, hello. Oh, there we go. We got you. Mr.
Are you
Ball.
Happy now?
Yes.
Fine.
There's one button that didn't get pushed. Fine. Thanks very much. And thank you for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Just for a second, maybe, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Slaves in the Family and how it is you came to write that book.
My father's family, the Ball family in South Carolina, controlled some 25 rice plantations over a period of 200 years, beginning in the year 1698. Straight through the Civil War and after. And we enslaved on those plantations close to 4,000 Africans and African Americans. I wanted to write about our family history in a way that would include both the black and the white side of the story. Normally, families like mine tell ourselves a story that only speaks about the people who lived in the mansions, and we don't say anything about the families that we enslaved. And I began Slaves in the Family with the intention of finding living black Americans whose ancestors we had held as slaves on our plantations, and meeting with them and, with their permission, telling some of their family history from slavery to the present. And the result was this book, Slaves in the Family, which was published 3 years ago.
You, as you explained now in the new book, Sweet Hell Inside, you were actually engaged in the writing of Slaves in the Family when you got a call from
an elderly lady, yes.
And who, I guess, and you were maybe a little bit taken aback when she said she was your cousin.
I was. She said that she was a non-white descendant of the Ball family, and she wanted to meet, and I agreed somewhat nervously to visit her in Atlanta, where she lived. And once we got to know each other, and we became more comfortable, she began to tell me her family story. Her distant ancestors were a white man named William Harlston and a black woman whom he had enslaved named Kate Wilson in the 1840s. William Harlston was a member of my father's family, the Ball family, by marriage. Mm. And so the descendant, Edwina Harlston Whitlock, and I are sixth cousins, two times removed, very distant, but nevertheless real kinship. Mm. And she told me the most remarkable family saga spanning four generations that impressed me so much that I wanted to tell it. And with her permission, this is what I've done in this new book.
Mm. Well, and the story does indeed here begin with William Harlston, who was a wealthy planter, and Kate Wilson, who was a slave.
Right, which is not unlike the Thomas Jefferson, Sally Hemings story. William Harlston was 38 years old, unmarried, when he began a relationship with a 16-year-old slave, Kate Wilson. And in the first year, it was about 1840, this had to have been a case of repeated rape. I think there's no other word to describe it. But what separated their relationship from other liaisons of this kind was that they stayed together for 35 years, and something grew in their relationship. They had 8 children together, and when William Harlson died, he left half of his estate to his common-law wife, Kate Wilson, the black woman. After that, Kate continued to raise her remaining minor children, and the Harlstons completely separated themselves from white society. This was also the way things went in the South. If a white man had mixed-race children, those children were immediately or eventually removed into black society, and they had no contact with their white relatives. However, there developed this a class of light-skinned African-Americans in the South because of so many mixed-race offspring who the Harlstons belonged to. And this was the first black middle class, you might say, in the United States, the so-called colored elite, who were able to get jobs and housing and education long before most African Americans were able to do that. Mm.
And was the color of their skin, the fact that they were lighter skinned, did that give them an advantage?
It gave them an advantage, but what gave them a special edge was their proximity to their white kin. In many cases, families, the white fathers of these children, although they disavowed them, sometimes educated them. There was a sort of paradoxical relationship that was carried on. And in the case of the Harlstons, most of these kids received an education and were literate, which was something highly unusual. And in this case, they inherited some property. They inherited a house in the city of Charleston, South Carolina, from their white father. So they were homeowners. And with their education, they began to become small business people. And all of this was going on while 95% of the black people in the South were still working in the fields as sharecroppers. So they were able to get a leg up much earlier than most black families.
As you mentioned, that William Harlston wanted to have his wealth, and apparently now after the Civil War, there wasn't that much anymore, not what there would have once been, but wanted it divided between his common-law wife, Kate Wilson, and a brother. And it seems as if the Harlston family, they didn't particularly like the idea, even if it was a small amount of money going to this black woman, and they made sure that she didn't get it.
Right. William Harlston left half of his estate to Kate, his African-American consort, and half to his white brother, John, which amounted to about several thousand dollars. And the white Harlstons, realizing what was going on, sent a member of their own to talk to Kate, and they persuaded her to sign a letter of agreement that turned over management of this money to them. And then they walked away with that money. So Kate was left without any cash inheritance. However, she managed to keep hold on the house that her common-law husband had bought her. And this became the kind of foundation of the family's prosperity.
And I gather that it may not that it's in terribly good condition, but the house actually stands. You have
the
a picture of it.
The house still stands today, yes. When they moved into it in the 1870s, it was new. It's now dilapidated, but it still stands in Charleston, yes.
Our guest this morning, just quickly to introduce again, is Edward Ball. His book, Slaves in the Family, won the National Book Award in 1998 for nonfiction. He's former columnist for The Village Voice and makes his home now in Charleston, South Carolina. He is the author of a new book that tells the history of this family, the Harlston family. The title is The Sweet Hell Inside. It is published by Morrow, William Morrow and Company, and is out now if you'd like to look at it. Questions are also welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. William Harleston and Kate Wilson had 8 children. The most successful was named Edwin.
Right. He was the most charismatic character, and he's one of the turning points of this book. He was 21 when his father, his white father, died, and he watched the family inheritance stolen away. And tradition is that this made him a driven, bitter man. He was medium height, barrel-chested, loud, cantankerous, domineering, a true patriarch who narrowed his gaze to show that he was not to be trifled with. And he went off and became a captain of a schooner that ran cargo up and down the Carolina coast and acquired the nickname Captain Harleston in the 1890s. Now, when that schooner went down in a shipwreck, he started another business, and he was looking around for a way to make back some of the wealth that had been taken from him. And if you were a black man in those days, there were only 2 professions that you could practice without harassment. One was you could be a preacher. The other is you could be an undertaker. Not being a religious man, Captain Harleston became an undertaker, and he founded a funeral home, the Harleston Funeral Home, that survives today. It's about 100-some years old, in Charleston. And this business threw off money and gave him and his children a high standard of living with servants and motor cars, with chauffeurs and fine clothes and silver, which was very unusual for black families in that day.
It's interesting. He actually got into this business initially by virtue of a family connection, because he had a sister and brother-in-law who were already in the business, and that's where he got his first exposure to it. And there again, it's an interesting story, because for a period of time they were in business together, and then eventually he went off, and then the brother-in-law dies and he comes back into that business, but then there's another kind of a falling out when a nephew comes in, so he goes off again on his own, so there's a little two different families with connections there.
Many zigzags and lots of family conflict along the way, all kinds. I mean, I don't know about your family, David, but mine is full of infighting and disagreements, which are smoothed over as much as possible for the public eye. But behind the scenes, the Harlestons were extremely combative and jealous of one another. So Captain Harleston had a sister and a nephew by that sister who were operating a funeral home together. And when Captain set up his own place, they became rivals. And he was especially resentful of this nephew, whose name was Eddie Mickey. Eddie Mickey was a sort of persnickety, fastidious dandy who was a closeted gay man. Now, we're talking about the year 1900, 1910, when to be gay was almost impossible in open society. And so Eddie Mickey had, in fact, married a woman in a way to acquire a beard. And Captain Harleston had knocked down, drag-out fights with his gay nephew, whose homosexuality he resented deeply, until finally they decided to go separate ways. And these 2 funeral homes, it's almost comical, became rivals in the city for the next several decades. They would fight over who gets the richest bodies, and they would bribe preachers to tell them when someone had gotten to their deathbed, so they could rush to the bedside and get first dibs on the family's body. And that's the way things unfolded in the back alleys of this family story.
And I guess too that we should mention for anybody who would not know that these 2 funeral homes served only black patrons.
That's right, yes. These 2 funeral homes served only black families. In fact, they served mainly light-skinned, middle-class black families who could afford their fees. And they buried their clientele in special cemeteries for the light-skinned, colored elite. These cemeteries were different from those used by darker-skinned working-class black families, and of course they were different from the white cemeteries. So Southern society was broken up into strata, and black society had its own strata, as did whites. The city of Charleston, for instance, was a majority black city. Say its population was 50,000 in those days, but nearly 30,000 people were African-American. In that group of 30,000, some 3,000 were members of this mixed-race colored elite, and they held themselves apart from the majority of black people who, in fact, resented them for their superior wealth and station.
In the book, one of the things that you describe, in addition to talking about the funeral business of the time, you talk about what it would cost. And when you think about the cost of a funeral today, it seems like pocket change, and that although you do have to see it in terms of the economics of the day,
right,
when a cost of a good funeral might be as much as $30,
right,
but that, as I think you explain in the book, is on average that would be 3 months' wages.
Wage for a black working class black man. That's right, and the coffin would be $10 or $12. So today, yes, you can buy an inexpensive coffin for $2,000. Putting it in context, and a decent funeral costs about $6,000, which might be the 3 months' wage of an hourly wage worker. So comparatively, it's about the same. The South was an economic desert at this time, having been pauperized by the Civil War some generation and a half before. There was a general level of poverty, and it was far deeper than that poverty in the North, in the northern states such as Illinois and Massachusetts and so forth.
You talked a little bit about the rivalry here between the two branches of the family, between the Harlestons and the Harleston Funeral Home and the one that was run by Eddie Mickey, the Mickey,
right,
Funeral Home. He apparently didn't make it through the Depression, though.
No, he didn't. Eddie Mickey, his wife left him, first of all, because he never consummated their marriage, and she went around town explaining why she had left him. And he carried on, nevertheless, in his funeral business, but he, in his attempt to one-up Captain Harleston, built an extravagant building for himself, and out of brick, just about 1929, which was a terrible time to be putting up a new building. And the Depression hit a year and a half later, and Eddie Mickey could not pay off his debt on this building, and creditors came to his door, and he had to shut down. He moved to New York, into Harlem, and opened another funeral home, the Carolina Funeral Home in 135th Street in Harlem, which operated for another five decades in New York.
We're almost at the midpoint here. Again, I want to mention that our guest this morning is Edward Ball. He's a former columnist for The Village Voice. He is the author of a book that won the National Book Award in 1998, Slaves in the Family, which is an exploration of his family's slave-owning past. And the new book, which is also about another branch of the family, is titled The Sweet Hell Inside. It's a story of the Harleston family, black middle-class family in Charleston, starting in the years after the Civil War, or perhaps a little bit before that, actually. The book is published by William Morrow, and it's just out now. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, before going on to talk a little bit about some of the children of Captain Harleston, maybe here we should introduce another character that becomes entangled in the story, and that's the Reverend Daniel Jenkins.
Sure. Well, Reverend Daniel Jenkins was a charismatic Baptist preacher in Charleston, South Carolina, in the late 1800s, who founded an orphanage for black children, the Jenkins Orphanage. And very soon, he was taking care of 200 to 300 black kids, most of them boys, some of them girls. And he and his wife ran this orphanage out of their goodness of heart, on the one hand, but also out of money that they would raise through various means. And Jenkins struck on a fundraising device for his ministry. He was a 6'4", booming-voiced, slow-speaking, slow-walking man who had quite a strong personal presence. He could silence a room merely by stepping up to the front of it and speaking out. And he thought that he could raise money from the white folks by entertaining them. He organized some of these orphan boys into a band that he called the Jenkins Orphanage Band. He gave them hand-me-down military uniforms and battered trumpets and trombones and sent them out into the street with some musical training to play ragtime and to play marches and to play popular songs. Now, this was about 1900, 1910. And these kids just drew money. Donations would come flowing from the pockets of the local people. And then Jenkins thought this was a great thing. He would send this group up and down the East Coast to Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, down to Charleston. And they would play in auditoriums and churches, raking in money and putting the Jenkins Orphanage on a firm footing. So Jenkins was a kind of Pied Piper figure of the working black population in Charleston. The Harlestons were looked down their nose at this man because he was uneducated, because he'd been born a slave, and he was darker than they were. But they would butt heads sometime later in the story.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely, because what happened was as one of the captain's daughters first went to work for the Reverend Jenkins as a secretary, then they started a relationship. She became pregnant, and apparently everybody, or a lot of people, knew about it anyway, but
right.
they ended up leaving. They go to England. She has the baby there, and
they abandon.
And they leave her there.
Yes. This child was named Eloise, or Ella Harlson, and she was 19 when she began an affair with the 42-year-old Reverend Jenkins. And she knew that if this baby was born, she would be in hot water. And he knew, he was married and had several children, he knew that if the baby was born, he would be in hot water. He had money enough to take the two to the UK, where they did abandon this child, which they named Olive. And then they returned to their home in South Carolina as though nothing had happened and resumed their lives there. So this is the kind of thing that women had to do in order to protect themselves from the kind of devastating codes of feminine propriety. Ella, of course, didn't want to surrender her infant daughter, but she thought that the consequences were so severe that she had no other choice.
And I don't know if we're giving too much of the story away here, but another odd twist is that later, many years later, when Reverend Jenkins' wife died, then he and Ella marry, and this was something that the captain was not at all happy about, apparently.
Right.
They actually end up adopting Olive.
That's right.
Bringing her back to the United States.
Right. Reverend Jenkins did marry his girlfriend, Ella Harlston, and he wanted to bring this abandoned child back to America, although Ella did not, because she knew that she would become a subject of gossip. So they struck a deal. They would bring the child home to South Carolina, and by this time she was 7 years old. She'd been living in England. The only black person that she knew was the one that she saw in the mirror. And she arrived home, so-called home, to Charleston and moved in with her parents. But Ella insisted that they adopt the child as though she were a foundling, like the many other orphans that the Jenkins Orphanage took care of. And so they took this outrageous step of going to the county registry and formally adopting their own child. Ella insisted that the girl not call her mother, but call her the same thing that the other orphans called her, which was Miss E.C. for Ella Chapman Harleston, which is her name. So this poor child, for her entire life, never was acknowledged by her own mother and never called her own mother the name mother, even though she knew exactly who her parents were.
Mm. And is it the case that a lot of people in the community knew, too?
Some knew, some didn't. It was a subject of speculation and gossip. People close to the families knew. The general population around didn't know. But it's a strange kind of soap opera. When you get into any family, I think that the most interesting secrets emerge. And this family is no different. My own family, the Ball family, we have told ourselves the story of the gallant antebellum plantation elite that we were at one time. And we have tended to forget all of the shenanigans that went on outside the big house and between unmarried lovers and so forth. Well, the Harleston family is no different. They have a kind of front door respectability, and they have a back door scandal. For instance, this figure, Captain Harleston, ran a funeral home at the front of his property. When his wife died, he took up with a woman named Mamie Randall, who was a nurse, and she moved into a cottage behind the funeral home. Well, as it turns out, Mamie Randall, who was a happy, short, kind of heavyset woman, had a strange angle on nursing. In reality, she was an abortionist. She was the town abortionist. So white women who could afford the procedure would arrive at the funeral home at night and walk down the alley between the buildings to the rear, to Mamie Randall's cottage, where they would have an abortion on her kitchen table before disappearing into the night. So literally in the front of the property, there was Captain Harleston embalming bodies, and in the rear of the property, there was Mamie Randall performing abortions on white women in trouble.
Hmm. It's an amazing story.
It's an interesting story. It's really a very interesting story, and what I like about it is that you can get close to these people. For white Americans, we so rarely allow ourselves to get close to black Americans as people. And as you read this story, as a white person, you are suddenly identifying with dozens and dozens of black people, and you allow yourself to forget that they are African Americans, which I think is very liberating for white people. And although this is not the reason why I wrote the story, I wrote the book because I thought it was an amazing saga, and it should be told.
And again, I think, as we've mentioned, I think, too, that there are a lot of folks who would argue that it's an important story because this is part of the story of black people in America that maybe hasn't gotten as much attention as it should, and no doubt has now started to get and will get more attention from historians and other people in the future, and that is the experiences of the black middle class.
Right. Sure. And this middle class was strongest in two cities in the South, Charleston on the one hand and New Orleans on the other. These were the two cities where interracial sex had the greatest tolerance among white people, and among black people, I suppose one could say that black families suffered to the greatest extent the consequences of interracial sex, most of it coerced. As a result, however, what we have is the Creole class in New Orleans, which are the mixed-race elites of that city, and a mixed-race elite in Charleston. And still to this day, the institutions of these families survive. They have their own churches, they have their own cemeteries, their own schools. They, at one time, had their own newspapers. They have their own businesses. They produce the majority of attorneys and physicians and so forth and so on. So these things You would think that the stories of black and white sex from long ago have very little presence today, but in reality, these stories extend right down to the present and have very concrete results in our time.
And I think, and also it leads one again to think about class, which is something here in America that we like to pretend doesn't exist, but of course, it does.
Yes, it does. Yes, the uncomfortable truth is that in black society, there is a class distinction that is based not only upon one's professional life, how one makes a living, but on one's skin color, which overlapped one's professional life for many generations. And there is, if it's possible to say this, there is racism in black society. Sometimes families with mixed race roots look down their nose at darker skinned families, and the matter of hair texture is very important. If one has smoother hair, then one is more privileged. There's resentment among some darker skinned families toward lighter skinned people for what they have and the advantages that they have had. So, yes, there is class, which overlaps skin color.
Let's talk about another of the captain's children, Teddy, who was an artist, someone who early on seemed to have a love and a talent for art, although I think what his father really wanted was for him to go into the business, into the funeral business with him. And I guess eventually he ended up finding a way to do both.
Sure. His name is Teddy Harlston. He was the son, one of the sons of Captain Harlston and a grandson of William Harlston and Kate Wilson, the founding couple. Teddy Harlston was a beautiful man of medium height with hollow cheeks and pale eyes. And he was an athlete in college at Atlanta University. This was at a time when only 1 in 1,000 black people went to college. He was an athlete, and he studied ancient literature. But he was most moved by drawing and painting from his early childhood. And he was sensitive and soft-spoken. As much as his father was domineering and sharp-tongued, Teddy was withdrawn and quiet. He drew and he painted. And he managed to get away from the South to go to art school in Boston. In 1906, he enrolled at the Museum of Fine Arts Art School in Boston, where he studied portrait painting, which was the predominant style of the day. And he became a portrait artist in the manner of John Singer Sargent or Mary Cassatt. He became quite accomplished, painted in a realist style, but he couldn't make a living as an artist because he couldn't get enough clients. And in fact, no African-American was able to make a living as an artist solely in those days. So he returned to Charleston and with his father ran the funeral home and continued painting at night and on weekends. His heart was always with his art, and he produced a couple of hundred canvases during the span of his lifetime. Some of them of the black businessmen of the day, the insurance executives, the physicians, the cosmetics queens, the people in education, the presidents of black colleges in the South. And he painted one well-known white man named Pierre DuPont in the 1920s. Pierre DuPont was the president of General Motors and the chairman of the DuPont Corporation and one of the five richest men in America. And Teddy had a very sad life because he was never able to separate himself from his domineering father and throw himself entirely into his art. But he was possibly the most important black painter in the South in the first half of the 1900s, completely unknown today, completely overlooked by art history, for reasons of Jim Crow, I think. He was unable to get a show anywhere. He could never get a gallery to represent him because galleries, art dealers would not represent black people. He could never get a foot in the door of the art market. And so he died, a relative unknown, at the young age of 49 in 1931. But his paintings survive, and I think that they're going to enjoy a resurgent interest in the coming years.
When he first went to college, he went to college in Atlanta. One of his teachers there was W.E.B. Du Bois.
That's right, yes. W.E.B. Du Bois, the great black intellectual, had just written his second and most influential book, The Souls of Black Folk, and he was a 35-year-old sociology professor at Atlanta University at the turn of the century, 1902-1903. And he became Teddy's mentor and drilled into Teddy the importance of the race, of fighting for the race. Now, Teddy could have, as many families like his had done, become a self-interested businessman. But Du Bois insisted to his protege that he do more. And when he got to Charleston, he founded the first chapter in the South of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. A.B. Du Bois had co-founded the organization in 1909 and was trying to open chapters around the country. And so Teddy ran the civil rights organization in addition to making paintings and running the funeral home at the same time. So he was a very busy man, an activist and an artist at the same time. Mm.
He married a woman named Elsie Forrest, who fell in love with Teddy, who came to know Teddy because her sister was dating one of his brothers,
right?
And she was so enamored of Teddy that when he gave her a camera, she apparently decided that perhaps that art would be something that would pull them together. She became interested and became a photographer, and eventually they had a studio together where he painted and she did photographs.
That's right, yes. Elsie Forrest was a young, fresh-faced woman in Charleston who was completely swept off her feet by Teddy, who was somewhat indifferent to her, at least initially, and she tried for years to reel him in. And she finally struck on this method of studying photography at Teddy's behest, because Teddy wanted an artistic partner. And she went off to New York at his expense to study photography, knowing that this would please him. And she returned to Charleston. They married after 7 years dating and opened an art studio, the Harleston Studio, in which Elsie photographed the sitters and Teddy painted them. Now, this studio was completely unique. There was nothing of its kind in the whole country, an art studio run by a black couple. Meanwhile, up in New York, there was the famous collaboration of Alfred Stieglitz and Georgia O'Keeffe, the couple, the photographer and the painter, who grabbed headlines all up and down the coast for their collaborations. But Teddy and Elsie worked quietly and in obscurity throughout the 1920s, producing art and photography in the Deep South at a time when, for a black man and a black woman even to consider becoming an artist was an outrageous fantasy. So it's really quite an unusual group of people here.
Mm. I'm afraid I misspoke, or maybe I misread there. It must be a bifocal error. Elsie, it was her name, not...
Right, not Elsie.
Elsie. The prints are really small here. And then sort of to bring us to the point where where we started, and I hope that I have this right, it was, there was a child, Elsie's sister and Teddy's brother, they got married, they had a child, he went off to World War I, got tuberculosis, came home, both of them got sick, and so Elsie and Teddy ended up raising the niece,
child, yes,
who was the woman who Edwina Harston Whitlock, who called you, that got this whole thing
started. That's right.
Started.
Bringing us full circle here, this child, whose parents were sick with tuberculosis, was passed off into the care of Teddy and Elise, who had no children of their own, and raised. Her name was Augusta, and initially her name was Augusta Harlston, or Gussie, and she was raised by this artist couple, whom she worshipped when she was growing up. Her uncle Teddy, this is what she called him, died when Augusta, or Gussie, was only 14, and she was so devastated that she changed her name to honor him. His name had been Edwin Harlston, so she changed her name to Edwina Harlston. She grew up, married a man named Whitlock, and bringing us full circle, Edwina Harlston Whitlock phoned me one Saturday afternoon in 1996 and announced that we were distant cousins, long removed.
And she was the one, as for anybody who was not at the beginning of the program, she was the one who, she called you and...
She was the one who got me started telling this story.
Yeah, she had all this material.
She had all this material she'd collected for decades. She had photographs, she had paintings, she had recordings, she had a tremendous memory for place and time, even the fragrance of things, and her anecdotes were so vivid that she drew me in and persuaded me to tell this story.
So she must be...
She's 85.
She must be pleased as well with the result.
She's pretty happy about it. Although, you know, I include a lot of scandalous material in the story that she would otherwise would have preferred not have been put there. She would start most of her anecdotes like this. Now, Edward, you're not going to put this in the book, are you? And then she would tell me about her Aunt Ella, who ran off with the Reverend Jenkins and had this illegitimate daughter, or something of that kind. And, of course, that's at least as interesting as the respectable accomplishments of the family.
Yeah. I think that's probably a dangerous thing to tell a journalist, to preface anything with, you're not going to go
right
with this,
sorry.
You're not going to include this, sorry.
No, you're not going to repeat this, sorry. It's just between us. What interested me here was a family that's produced two incredible strains of cultural life that were very important in American art history and music history. Teddy Harlston, the unrecognized portrait artist, was one, the high art tradition. And then Ella Harlston Jenkins, who, with her husband, supervised this band of teenage boys, the Jenkins Orphanage Band. This Jenkins band, produced a lot of musicians who had great careers in jazz. For example, there was a guy named Freddie Green, who was a Jenkins orphan, who ran off and became the guitarist for the Count Basie Orchestra for 50 years. There was a guy named Cat Anderson, who was an orphan 9-year-old trombone player, who switched instruments and went off and became a trumpet player, joined the Duke Ellington Band, and he was the high note trumpet player for the Duke Ellington Band for 20 years. And other musicians would say that Cat Anderson plays notes so high that only a dog could hear them. And there was a guy named Jabbo Smith, who was another trumpet player who was runaway from the orphanage, and Ella and Reverend Jenkins would have to call the police every time he ran away. And finally he got away for good and went to New York and became a rival of Louis Armstrong in the 1920s, and he and Louis Armstrong would have these trumpet duels on stages in Harlem and in Chicago, attracting 1,000 people to watch these two young men square off against each other. So this one family, the Harlstons, had their feet in high art and in the high art, in the fine art of painting, and in the street art of jazz music, at the same time. And it's really quite a family saga.
Yeah, it is a fascinating story, and I think it fits well into a kind of history that we're starting to see more and more of, and that is history of more regular folks,
right.
not people who were perhaps the biggest movers and shakers of their time,
right.
Not the first names that people get in their history class, but people who nonetheless imported and contributed in very important ways to history. And I think, you know, the one quote that seems to be repeated in everything I read about this book, but which I think is a very, very good one, is that your line about family history being history in miniature.
Right. It is a microcosm of the wider movements. And what I try to do is to get people close to the figures in this family so that you know them. You can almost see them in front of you. You can fantasize a conversation with them. And behind them, in the front of the story, are these people, the Harlestons, Captain Harleston, his abortionist girlfriend, Teddy Harleston, his photographer wife, and Ella Harleston and her scoundrel husband. Behind them are the wider movements of history. Meanwhile, you know, World War I is taking shape. Meanwhile, lynching is going on in the Deep South. Meanwhile, the KKK are rioting at night, terrorizing people. Meanwhile, the cotton boom has gone bust with the boll weevil and all these other things that affected people's lives. Meanwhile, black people are getting contracts with jazz recording companies for the first time. So it goes back and forth from the people in the front of the story to the back of the story. And the family, the Harlestons, become a window on America as you make your way through their saga.
Well, there we've come to the end of the time, and that's a pretty good place for us to conclude. We want to say thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David. Appreciate the invitation.
Our guest, Edward Ball. And if you'd like to read his book, once again, it's titled The Sweet Hell Inside, and it is out now recently. It's published by William Morrow and Company.